Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast. This is your host, Jamie Russo. Thank you for joining me today. Today, my guest is Jonathan O'Byrne. He was an expatriate in Singapore, desperate for workspace and community. Not finding an offering that combined both, he started his own brand, Collective Works, and quickly became one of the fastest growing brands in Singapore. He entered a joint venture with one of the largest REITs in Singapore, hoping to support his growth and provide easier access to his preferred Class A real estate. Jonathan shares that story and his lessons learned and what he's up to now and his perspective on the co-working market today. He now lives in Brisbane, Australia, and is finishing his second book. You can grab his first book, which we talk about a little bit on the podcast today, Coworking Inc., the Bohemian Movement that Adopted Capitalism, on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Before we dive into Jonathan, I have two opportunities to share with you today. If you are working on opening a coworking space, I want to invite you to join me for my free masterclass, The 3 Behind the Scenes Secrets to Opening a Coworking Space. If you're working on starting a coworking space, I want to share the 3 decisions that I've seen successful operators make when they're creating their co-working business. The masterclass is totally free. It's about an hour, which includes Q&A time. If you'd like to join me, you can register at everythingcoworking.com/masterclass. If you already have a co-working space and you're starting to look ahead to 2021, can you believe we are just about 60 days until the end of this crazy year? And I don't like to count December because December gets crazy even without gatherings and whatnot. People are distracted by holidays and wrapping things up for the year. So we are almost there. We've got about a month left. So you're probably wondering how the heck to plan for such an unknown. We're going to tackle that together. We will not have the same planning focus coming out of a global pandemic as we would in a more typical year. But we're going to take a 9-step approach to getting ready to thrive in 2021. So survive means to continue to live or exist, especially in spite of danger or hardship, which is what we saw in 2020. Thrive means to prosper, to be fortunate or successful, to grow or develop vigorously, to flourish. So we can't predict what 2021 will mean for our businesses, but by planning in advance how we will approach the year, we can be intentional and more in control, and we can find opportunities to grow and to thrive. So I want to help you to prepare for 2021 confidently so that you have both the mindset and the business that is ready to compete for incoming post-COVID demand. And I know that many operators today are feeling uncertain, maybe burned out, unsure of what to do next, and some not sure that you can survive. So you feel a little not in control, maybe unfocused and stuck. And if you feel that way, you're not alone. But those feelings are not healthy for you or for your business. And I think that with an intentional plan for how you and your team will approach 2021, you will feel happier, more positive, less stressed at work and at home, and you'll be prepared to focus on the right things and to be able to see the new opportunities that are coming. And let me tell you, in part of the workshop, so I'm hosting a workshop called Designed to Thrive in 2021. I would love to have you join me. You can get the details at everythingcoworking.com/thrive2021. If you're on my email list, you have a couple of emails with the links in it already. So take a look at all of the details. There are 2 options. There's a free option, which gets you access to the first session, which will be super meaty. We're going to dive into the planning approach and get some actual planning done. And then we're doing 2 additional sessions that go deeper into the process. And the third session is actually kind of an accountability hot seat Q&A session in January. So take a look at the options. The first session is totally free. You can do the all-in option, which is a paid option, but includes the additional two sessions. And I have some guest speakers that are going to join us, and some of them are going to share some of the opportunities that they've already taken advantage of that are out of the box and do not depend on people coming into their space for revenue. And we're going to do some mindset coaching. We have some exciting components to the workshop. So it's not webinar style per se. There will be some content, but we're going to workshop, we're going to interact, we're going to work on our business, and we're going to get a plan on paper for 2021. So you can check that out at everythingcoworking.com/thrive2021. And now please enjoy my conversation with Jonathan. I'm here with Jonathan O'Byrne, founder of Singapore co-working space Collective Works and the author of recently released book, Coworking Inc., the Bohemian Movement That Adopted Capitalism. Although this is only a first in a series, he's already on book number two, which maybe we'll get to talk about. But I have read the book, and we're going to talk about Jonathan's co-working journey and some of the topics that he addresses in the book. And Jonathan is sitting in his new home in Brisbane, waiting for all of his lifelong belongings to arrive on a shipping container from Singapore, which someone else packed. So fingers for all of those, for your life's history, that it will survive its journey. But thank you for making time to chat today. I'm looking forward to it.
Likewise, Jamie, thank you for having me. And thank you for being one of the 10 people who's read my book.
Well, we're going to link to it in the show notes. If you have Kindle Unlimited, it is temporarily free in the US. I don't know if that's the case everywhere. So snag it while you can. I did. I got to read it for free. And awesome. It's a good read. I told Jonathan there were things that I wish that I had said, because I thought he described them really well. But Jonathan, I'm really interested in your story. We were just talking about the second book and how there are things that you've lived through and seen that, you know, has really shaped your perspective and that you feel like you need to share. Tell us your co-working story. How it initially happened, and then some highlights of your journey, and then we'll get into some specific questions.
Sure.
Where to start? So, I know.
Where to start? So I am, I guess the first piece is that I'm a lifelong expatriate. So I grew up internationally. My parents took me overseas when I was a month old, and I never went home. So I've been living overseas, but for long stretches in each country. So my individual skill set that I developed with that was building communities as I went, because you have to reinvent every time you move. And that's the process that you've alluded to right now. So I'm in Brisbane. I've had to get into some new networks. Thankfully, I'm a member of EO. So I got into EO Brisbane and all that kind of stuff. But when I moved to Singapore 10 years ago, I was 24, difficult to get into a network, didn't really have any money, was just starting out in business. People don't really want to talk to you when you're that age. And so I had my own business for 2 years. I ran it from home. It was in PR and branding. And I basically hated my life is the short version of that. And I was financially successful, but emotionally unfulfilled. And started looking for somewhere to work or somewhere to go to every day to get out of the house, to meet people, and realized that the space I wanted didn't exist. I looked at, I'd say about 45 spaces in Singapore, and they were all various degrees of nicely appointed beige boxes. Mm-hmm. And no community, no connection. And then I thought, what if I created a space that actually fostered connection, got people speaking to each other? Because I remember walking out of a one particular service office, which was it's on the marina in Singapore. So it's really pretty, low rise building, but like right on the water. Great feng shui. And they had this notice board at the front, and literally it was this list of names, and it was everything from this incredible female VC who'd just been featured in, I just read about her in the Business Times, and she was there, and Skype was there, And there was just, it was like this veritable who's who of like PR, branding, legal, tech. And I was like, if these people actually spoke to each other, this would be really, really fortuitous.
I want to like run down the hallway and open all the doors and come out. Yeah. Let's talk. But,
yeah. But I remember asking when you know, on the tour, I was like, well, do they do any events? And they were like, we have a Christmas party once a year. And I'm not, I don't even believe that they do the Christmas party every year. I think they just said it to me as sales spin. Yeah. And they had this tiny little scuddy pantry, like in the back, which had this like super skinny little, it was a like a little bar that you could like put your coffee on, but it was, wasn't more than a foot wide. And it was like, it was red Korean and it was like, there's like zigzag. And I'm like, well, that's really helpful because no one's going to spend any time here. So there was just, there was no, no circulation space. Anyway, so the faster version of that is I got so mad leaving that meeting. And I was like, fine, I'm starting my own. And I have a background in interior design. My uncle's an architect. I interned with him when I was a teenager. My parents have dabbled in buy-to-let properties since I was five. So I've been like doing up properties and stuff since I was little with my family. So I was like, I can design this. I have a PR degree. I should be able to market this. Right. I'm a little bit social. I should be able to socialize it. So then entered into the process, just dived headfirst into doing leases, working with contractors that don't speak English, and that whole fun thing in Singapore, opened my first space. The short version from that was the first 6 months were a little tense. Then we ended up being full. Then 8 months in, I was building two additional floors in that building. 10 months in, another floor. Then another floor. Then I joint ventured with a company called Capitaland, which is one of the largest real estate companies in Asia. So if you don't know them, if you're from the US, Capitaland has $118 billion in assets under management. I was dealing with the Singapore subsidiary, not the whole holdco. But yeah, they own, I think 11 of the top ultra grade A buildings in the Singapore CBD. So that whole portfolio, I think, is just under $9
billion. So what was it that drove that explosive growth? Was it generic pent up demand or pent up demand for your specific offering?
I think it was pent up demand from my specific offering. I'm biased. I would like to think that.
Of course, it was Jonathan.
but let's examine that a little bit more. I think I was the first co-working operator to open in the CBD. I pitched myself at a price point that was about 75% the price of the service offices at the time. So it was a good value proposition. We were making fair profits and we had this whole other piece, which was community events, engagement. And I think, as I shared to you in the past, Jamie, part of my product very quickly became about market entry, because when you're an expat, you get very good about understanding how to get into markets. So joining within our first year, we did a deal with the British Chamber of Commerce in Singapore that our members became de facto members of that Chamber of Commerce. So they were then into a professional network of like 3,500 people that were all the, you know, heads of banks, heads of, incredible, you know, Rolls Royce and all that kind of stuff. So that then got them into, so they had my event network and the British Chamber of Commerce event network, which runs, gosh, I think they run something like 200 events a year. Wow. And I was also at the time I was chairing the Entrepreneur and Small Business Committee at the, it's called BritCham. So at BritCham. So I was running, that event calendar and my own event calendar. So it became for me, it was a magnification proposition. It wasn't just get a desk in an office. It was get a desk, get connected to all these people, get into these events.
And your product mix, when you say co-working versus serviced office, do you offer offices?
In the first version one, no. Version one was entirely open space. The first expansion was the first floor was just open space. Second floor was a mix. It was actually more offices with some open space because I did it to counteract the first one. I was just, I realized quite early there was this juggling action of enough of the different quantums of space. And then the floor that went with that was a 50-50 split of office and open. And then the one that went after that was a 75% office. And then the one that went after that was probably also 75% office. Yeah.
You mentioned at the time of your joint venture, you had 30% share of the market in Singapore.
I did. Yeah.
So
that was fun.
But you had found something, you had struck a chord. And so we were talking about kind of the soul of co-working. And
we were.
So talk about your joint venture. What was the why behind that for the asset owner and for you, and kind of what did that process, why?
Sure. I think so expanding in co-working, as you well know, very expensive proposition. Yeah. So even if you're doing well, there's no way we could have recovered the capital in the first kind of 8-9 months of operation. So I was putting in more money. I was putting in good money after good money.
To expand, right. What are the, what do lease lengths look like in Singapore?
They vary, but they actually tend to be quite short. So you're also, that's the other challenge in Singapore, is that your capital and your fit out is at risk. So actually the very first floor I did, I put most of the money into furniture and I designed everything kind of on wheels so that if we got kicked out, I could literally clear it and move it. And then as I got, as we got a bit further and I developed a bit more confidence in the landlords that we were working with, we did more of a kind of fixed fit. But yeah, the why for the deal, I think it was multifaceted. I think I was by that stage, the point at which I did my joint venture, co-working, my business in particular, because we were a CBD operator, had attracted a lot of interest from service office operators. We had been approached for an acquisition by one Asian service office operator. I'd been asked to franchise into Hong Kong at that point. And then I was in discussions with three different real estate trusts. So in Asia, real estate is kind of the family hobby. So it is just sort of, first of all, I was a foreigner in corporate real estate, which was very unusual. And we were growing very rapidly. And obviously we were making a bit of a noise with that process. And some of the existing operators were losing clients to us. So I think from the perspective of the real estate trust that we worked with, they were looking for, one, they could see this as an emerging trend. They wanted to kind of dip their toe into it in a way that let them understand it more without it being too risky for them to do. They knew they didn't have the expertise in-house. They were very upfront with me when they said they didn't have the expertise in-house. So they essentially saw it. They were like, this is an emerging trend. We'd like to be at the forefront of this. But we can't do with this as a whole, as an organization. So let's ring fence this. And our joint venture was described as an experiment from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, they granted access to a portfolio of real estate I couldn't get access to otherwise. So their buildings are very difficult to get into. Interestingly, I think from the outsider, you think, oh, you'll get mates rates. You'll get cheaper leases. Yeah. You do not when they are publicly listed, because your leases have to be externally benchmarked and audited. So no, I got a rack rate lease. But I also, I suppose at that stage, I saw them as potentially a source of expansion capital, which they didn't turn out to be. I was considering a bunch of different options. Being taken over by a service office operator felt like it would take the soul out of the business. Some of the other real estate trusts didn't seem as progressive. And I didn't feel like they would get it. And the one I partnered with, I thought seemed to be more modern. So that was the rationale at the time. It was expansion. It was securing a market.
What turned out to be the benefit of the joint?
That's a difficult one, because I think that is a difficult one, because I've done a lot of reflection since. And actually, if you put me back in time and I could do the time over again, I wouldn't do the joint venture. I would just keep expanding by myself.
Okay. Ooh.
And
you mentioned maybe it was in an email that you sent, and I know we think differently about, you know, management agreements and joint ventures. So tell me what you meant by that.
So I think it's notoriously difficult to, so when I did this deal with this billion-dollar corporate, I had 3 employees and then we did the deal and then I had 16 employees and my business went through, what was it? Was it 300% growth in a quarter? It was literally, we put something like $2 million in revenue on the business in the first quarter. And it was just, that process broke everything. So it broke my team, it broke some of our systems. We were then doing that, growing rapidly, doing a system migration because our old system couldn't handle what we were doing. I was onboarding 11 new staff. It was just, the whole thing became really, really challenging.
Yeah.
And I think from the other challenge from the other side is when people work in large institutional organizations, they don't think about revenue because it's always there. So there wasn't the empathy or the understanding of what an operating business looks like from a trust, because real estate trusts build buildings, they rent them. So they're always generating some kind of income. You know, it's like, are we at 90% or are we at 85%? Their world doesn't revolve around billing and income the way that small businesses do. Mm-hmm. So there was a really big learning curve to take them on as a operator. So essentially, at one point, before I sold my business, I asked my team how much of a productivity tax, the ones that have been there the whole time, how much of a productivity tax they felt, or how much of their day they were spending servicing the joint venture. And the average answer was 30%. So the team had lost 30% of their productive capacity just by entering into the joint venture. And I think one of the very early discussions I had, we were doing, because we had to do this monthly reporting into this joint venture because they were publicly listed and they were constantly preparing filings. I got some queries back and one of the CEOs asked me about them. And I said to her, I said, do you realize that you actually, I said, how many people are in that department? And she was like 19. I said, do you realize you have more people checking my numbers than I actually have making the money? And she was like, that's a little embarrassing. And I'm like, I thought so too. And because I'm pretty sure your guys are probably also more highly paid than mine are.
Right.
So, so I was like, the economics here of the checking and the revenue are completely off kilter. And the thing is, their organization could do that and not even notice it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I would love 19 highly trained accountants in my business. We could do amazing things with that. Yeah. You know,
right.
Would you like to secon some of them? And I think there was just this David and Goliath element of it from the beginning. So that was one. Also, I was already growing at a normalized 40% per annum.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what happened with the joint ventures? I did one huge expansion, which broke everything. If I hadn't done that, I would have done another little 50%, 50%, right. And I would have got bigger. The process of breaking systems and stuff like that would have been more progressive. It would have been easier to handle through that growth.
More organic, because there would have been a pacing to it where you could sort of Absolutely. See it coming and catch up to it and
yes.
yeah, manage it.
Yeah. And then I think the other aspect was just the autonomy of doing business. So I entered into a 50-50 joint venture. It was only a joint venture for that location, but that was the location we became famous for, because it was the one which I'd been running this old location for 5 years. We had all the learnings. We could throw all those learnings into one new center.
Yeah.
It was the first grade A building. Yeah. It was in the fourth tallest building in Singapore. It was, you know, it was really beautiful. It had Herman Miller furniture, beautiful. We had 9,000 square foot of herringbone floor. It was just lovely. Really lovely space to spend time in. And so essentially when people wanted us to do more, that was that. The other piece was that it actually became an obstacle for me getting further leases, because I partnered with a real estate operator.
Okay.
I was then seen to be on an opposing team.
Yep.
So other buildings were then other buildings and other landlords either assumed that Capital Land owned more of my business than they did, or that they're kind of the response I would get would be, why would you come to us for property? They have that portfolio. So it became, I guess I was no longer seen as an independent. Mm-hmm. So that also impacted my own ability to expand and run my own business outside of that partnership.
Yeah.
And when you get into a relationship, so then what that does is it forces codependency. And when you get into a business, as in life, if you end up in a relationship where there is a codependency, it becomes really a bit icky, because then it's just sort of, there's this internal thing of, well, we now need each other to expand. They couldn't do co-working. I couldn't access other real estate. So essentially that it's, and then we got to a point where we as a team couldn't agree on an expansion pathway. So then I sold them the business.
that was kind of the path to the end.
Yeah.
So,
well, actually I tried to buy the business back first, and then they said, no, we'll have it. So that was the way to the end.
Are you anti joint venture for everyone, or can you see cases in which it makes sense?
I'm not anti joint venture for everyone, but I think the first factor would be to address the David and Goliath issue. So if you're going into a joint venture with a real estate operator, you want to be dealing with someone which is, they can be bigger, but you don't want them, 10 to the 9 bigger than you.
Right. Know? No, I think that's an important point. And the reporting requirements. I mean, it's the trade-off people talk about with public companies, right? As you grow, you have more responsibility and you go public. There's all this reporting requirement. And do you want that?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of different ways. So for example, the way we structured this joint venture, we created a new company. We both co-funded it. We put half the money in on both sides, and we built this new center. The other way we could have done this is I could have just taken that money from them, put it into my business, and given them a shareholding.
Yep.
And that would have been far more efficient.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because it's a, the first is the David and the Goliath issue. The second is a structuring issue, and just going, how much, what is the quantum of money that you're getting? What is the most efficient way of dealing with that doesn't create huge amounts of regulatory complication? Yeah. Because the other complexity with this is, because of the way we did the joint venture, I was then licensing in a whole bunch of stuff from other areas of the business, and it created this whole intercompany billing situation that we never had before. So we made the day-to-day operating the business 8 times more complex.
Yeah.
Then we had that 30% additional reporting requirement.
Right.
It became so heavy. You can see how the energy came out of the growth, because it was all going into other areas.
And your team was used to focusing on community building and connecting people and the reasons why people came to you. And now they're being pulled into spreadsheets and real estate. Well,
I managed to keep a really big split between my team. So we had, I split my team into operations, who were kind of my front desk team, my community and events team, which were the kind of, they'll have coffee with you. And then we had the kind of back end finance.
Okay. Got it.
Exec code. Yeah. So, but even still, the other challenge, and this is actually a community management challenge, when you throw that many new members into a community, you don't have an existing, you don't have community policing, because essentially when you build a co-working space, you know this, but I'll say it for the purpose of the recording. Mm-hmm. When you build a co-working space, you enroll people into the group culture of a space. And then that group culture becomes self-policing. So if you put your cup in the wrong place, people say, actually, in this co-working space, we put them in the dishwasher, or we leave them here in this basket. So I had maybe 5 front desk team managing 300 plus new members. No one knew what the rules were, even though they'd all been given like rule onboarding packs. There weren't enough people there to police it.
The words mean nothing until the culture, right? And you can't be intentional in front with the culture and ease, again, the organic piece. It's just that's super interesting. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So just basically it made every aspect of running the business harder than it had ever been before. The stakes were higher. We were very, very public. And then the economics of the spaces we were running were very different because we were in this now in this super grade A environment. And even, I mean, we early on, I mean, I lost one customer because the building had a dress code. And we had this one very hot, very famous tech startup out of Northern Europe. And their CEO notoriously likes wearing Bermuda shorts. And he was like, I think he's ex-Bain or ex-Goldman or something. And he was like, I'm never going to wear a suit again.
Yeah.
And then the issue of the shorts came up. And then so we lost this huge tech company because it didn't, because the joint venture partner, who's also the landlord of the building, was conflicted. And I think that's the other piece there is when you do as a co-working operator, when you do a joint venture with a landlord, they are intrinsically conflicted because they have two competing interests. Yeah. One is their stake in your joint venture, which is a small component of their duties to a building.
Right.
So another example I can give you is we ended up opening the joint venture space far faster than I initially wanted to, because they didn't want to have sitting vacancy in the building.
Right.
So that was something I agreed to. I take responsibility for it. I felt pressured into doing it and I did it. And it was very, very expensive to do it. But again, that's not a thing that you'd have from somebody who was just if I look at the quantum of money that we did in the joint venture, I could have got a bank loan. I could have got an angel investor or an outside investor. They've taken VC money. There were plenty of ways to get that money with far fewer strings. And I could have found a different building. You know, I already had, at the point at which we were expanding, I was looking at there's a building in Singapore called the SGX, the Singapore Stock Exchange. And they have some lovely towers above them. They're a little older, but they're still quite nice. And they're in really good location. We could have taken a floor there by ourselves. And it would have been a different product. It would have been a different progression. But none of these crazy hurdles. I mean, on the flip side, if you want a big growing experience, go do a joint venture. Right.
Which is what you experienced, yeah. And why you feel, I feel like you this book is inside of you that needs to come out, right? And that's part what you're working on now, which is the sort of the evolution of the real estate cycle and how co-working has impacted that. So I'm really curious to read the second book since you're kind of talking about. So if a landlord, because I says, you know, you're talking about in the second book about the disruption of co-working, what does an asset owner do when they see sort of start to get it and want to integrate? If not a joint venture,
what is my advice to an asset owner?
Yes. If you feel like the joint venture is fraught with many trade-offs, but we worry about them doing it on their own and you want more integration, what do you have a theory on the best structure?
It's very difficult to do what is the best structure without having the particulars of each of the two parties involved. I mean, in structure, so compared to what I did, structures that would be neater would one have been a straight acquisition. They just bought us.
Yeah.
Because then they would have won, they would have, there wouldn't have been the reporting. We would have just been part of them.
Yep.
We would have had access to their resources. Mm-hmm. So those 19 accountants that were monitoring
us. Then they could have been your accountants, really. Yeah.
They would have been her accountants. So I think it does away with the them and us mentality. Because I think that was something I was really managing with across both teams, actually. Because we'd have this, we were sort of, the interesting thing about it was the joint venture made me feel like an employee, even though I owned the business.
Sure.
Because I was then answerable to somebody else and there was no back reporting to me. So it was sort of so straight acquiring would have been easier. And actually at that stage, they probably could have gobbled us up for peanuts. You know, we weren't a big company. And then they would have acquired the brand, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
So straight acquisition is one. I would say fund them and leave them alone. So like go more of the venture capital route of put money into them and then step back, act like an investor. Mm-hmm. Which actually, so the interesting thing about the company I worked with is they actually decided to spread bet across co-working operators. So they joint ventured with me, they funded another one. They VC funded some in Vietnam and then when they bought my business, they actually then bought into, their final decision they ended up with was they bought one.
Okay.
And then they acquired me through that vehicle.
Okay.
So because again, even at the point of acquisition, 3 years in, they didn't have the skill set within the organization to run a co-working business.
Right.
So they still needed the management skill. So from one of the things that we were talking about before we hit record was what I call the problem of asset mindset. And so many people in real estate are used to assets, buildings, and they look at buildings, they look at numbers like yield, occupancy, and it's incredibly impersonal. And co-working is actually all about connection, community, the individual, personal needs, user experience, humanizing the relationship with real estate. Co-working came out of people being very annoyed that there was no relationship around their physical environment.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm spending so much money, so much time in the space, and I'm getting nothing from it. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a take relationship. So co-working made it a give and take. It was a back and forth. And the difference, it's really critical for an asset manager to move from that mindset of asset to community. But those are actually the same as you have accountants and salespeople. They're different people. So that's why, in my opinion, if you're a large asset owner looking to get into co-working, you should acquire an asset owner or acquire the management team, because you need that skill set and you don't have it. And it is a, when I did a talk at RETAS, the real estate conference in Singapore, and I did this pitch called a co-working REIT. And basically, normally with a traditional REIT, you've got a REIT structure, which holds a building, and a REIT manager, which is responsible for getting the yield.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's an argument for a co-working REIT manager as a sub article of that, because a REIT manager will get you 3%, 4% yield. A co-working manager will get you 35% yield. It's not going to take over the whole building yet,
mm-hmm. Right.
But for now it's going to bump the yield of the whole building.
Yeah.
And actually what we're looking at now, particularly, and again, we were saying this in the pre-chat, COVID has bumped up the evolution of co-working and flexible working by 4 or 5 years, because it's killed a bunch of leases. I was just telling you, I'm doing my annual filings at the moment. I was on a Zoom call with my accountants in Singapore. They don't have an office. They gave up their office. They gave up their lease because Singapore has been in work from home since March.
Yep.
So the co-working industry in Singapore is decimated right now, because literally people are bailing out of their leases. Why would you pay for an apartment? Even if it has the best community on the planet, no one's there.
Yeah.
So we're at this inflection point of a lot of the normal operators, unless they're well-funded, will turn over.
Yeah.
A lot of the traditional real estate, they're going to have issues with people downsizing, and they're going to have this influx of space. So we're at this point right now where, yes, landlords should be looking at creating co-working like products, but they still don't have the skill set.
Yep.
And the skill set takes years to develop. And then you need to have the mindset,
yeah. Right? This is the challenge, to your point. They're two different people.
Yes.
So they have to acquire that competency and that mindset. And then they have to respect it, because yep. they have to respect that maybe they don't quite get it.
Yes.
They sort of broadly get it, and then let the operator go at it and do what they do, even if they, you were telling the story about sitting in a meeting and talking about soul as sort of a metric.
Like, yes.
I'm sorry, say that again. What?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So, yeah. I mean, exactly. I was sitting at but on that point, so when I used to recruit people in my business, we used a psychometric profiling tool called a Berkman profile. And a Berkman profile is essentially a 4-window pane grid. And the north-south axis is high extroversion to high introversion. The east-west axis is people-oriented, object-oriented. So asset management is high introversion, object-oriented.
I see where you're going here. Yes.
co-working management is high extroversion, people oriented, with some systems support. But you still need to be high extroversion systems management. So
yep.
when you're trying to build an optimum team using something like a Berkman profile, you need people in every quadrant, and you have to respect their differences, because mm-hmm. These are your best accountants. These are your best assistants. These are your best sales and marketing. These are your best engineers. So what traditional real estate don't understand is that they all sit on one side of a Berkman grid, and they're all hired in their own image. So they're all basically object focused, systems focused, systems or numbers focused. And this is why co-working feels like these sparkly aliens to them. They're like, why are you guys, you know, why are you all extroverts? Why have you all got funny hair? Why are you all, why do you all look like you work at an Apple store?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I think I told you on another call that we had, when I first did my joint venture, the real estate company seconded in a group of people initially because they wanted to experience co-working.
Yep.
And the team were in the space for 5 minutes. And one of the venture capitalists in my space came up to me and were like, who are the dudes in chinos with IBM ThinkPads? They don't belong here. Literally verbatim quote. And I was like, ah, they're from, you know, Capitaland. And he just threw his head back and started laughing. He was like, that makes sense. He's like, they are not your clients. They are not your people. They're messing with your community dynamic. So yeah, it's, so yeah, I think the answer, Jamie, is individual circumstances as far as a landlord. From a co-working operator, I think right now, have some humility. You know, I think what's required here is mutual respect. I don't know how to build a real estate trust. That's a whole other area of expertise and a degree that I didn't do.
Yeah.
But what I can do is generate more money per square foot than renting can. And I can do it sustainably for many years. And that's a skill set that has value. So yeah, there's an ecosystem which hasn't quite gone together yet. And it requires the shift. I guess it requires accepting that set it and forget it, real estate's over. And I think real estate for so long has been sign the lease, ignore them for 2 to 4 years and come back and be like, are you staying? If not, rip out all your fit and give it back to me. Like it's saying it now, knowing that there is a world where there's co-working, it sounds like madness, you know, and environmentally reckless actually, but
totally. Right. Exactly. Now that we've seen what's on the other side, you think, right, why have we been doing that? And how could that possibly go on? I'm curious about a couple of practical things that you talk about in the book. So sure. Taking a little bit of a turn from the joint venture talk, but
sure, no worries.
I'm curious about terms, because you talk about in the book sort of this balance of managing a space that has some people in there on flexible terms and some people in there on longer terms.
Yep.
And now COVID hits and everyone's uncertain and no one wants longer terms. What do you think that will look like as we start to kind of return?
I think, well, first of all, I think the page you're talking about is this one.
Yes.
Where I've got this sort of bell curve of length of membership term and then income costs or then recurring cost per person. That's how I think co-working spaces work, but I know it isn't for all of them. How do I think this is going to work? I think, I think length of term is actually sometimes a misnomer for how long okay, when you're selling a co-working space, length of term is how you evidence future revenue.
Mm-hmm.
When you're running a co-working space, I had one they were a recruitment firm, really awesome recruitment firm out of Sydney, and they were on rolling monthly for 5 years,
right? Yes.
And what that meant to that that founder was, when she was like, when I hire one person, I can bump it up. When I lose a person, I can bump it down. And actually what I found early in my co-working experience was actually flexibility was sticky, because you couldn't get flexibility.
Right.
So the stickiness of flexibility,
yes,
is a factor. And I think now, post-COVID, that flexibility is going to be a deciding factor, because no one knows what they want to do. So everyone wants to hedge. So if you allow them to hedge, it might give you some butterflies in your stomach, but they'll probably stay with you if they can't hedge somewhere else.
Yeah.
The other move, I think, Jamie, is I've been talking for a couple of years now about big institutional lessors of space, so corporates moving to per head leasing models. I really see that coming quite quickly now. So, and I think they're in a bargaining position where they can get it. So there hasn't been the impetus So there may have been the client demand before, but I think there are so many companies around the world looking at their real estate portfolio with 90% of their teams working at home going, we're spending how much money, you know, and we don't need it. Yeah. And it's not enriching people's lives. And some of them are actually happier at home. It's, you know, they know they need to get them together. They know there's a core of space that they need, event space, town halls, you know this. But I think we're actually really pushing that up too.
So you're seeing a power shift so that the occupier can say to the landlord, we're not playing by your rules anymore. Here's what we want to buy. Do you think that it'll be a direct to landlord relationship, or do you think there will be a flex space operator in the middle?
I think large institutional lessors of space. So something like 90% of CBD space goes to multinational companies. It doesn't go to small businesses. Yeah. I don't think there's ever been, so those businesses are very reactive with their real estate. They try and do this like 5-year forecast. They always get it wrong, and they just constantly are reacting to circumstances. There has never been a point in recent history where they have been so misaligned from a real estate perspective than they have in the past. So I feel like every Fortune 500 company right now is going, what is our flex real estate option? So that I think is just what's happening. They then go to JLL or to CBRE and go, give us an option.
Because that's their traditional channel.
They go to their broker. Mm-hmm. And JLL and CBRE have varying degrees of quality of offering. I know JLL has been working on their own, and CBRE was starting to do its own co-working thing. Yeah. And then they'll try and kit fit something together. But actually, when we look at companies that have actually survived COVID really well, the example of McDonald's versus some of the other fast food chains, McDonald's has this massive distribution network. They're everywhere you need them to be. A landlord that has a large distributed portfolio has a better co-working proposition than a co-working space, because the landlord could put in a co-working fit. They're just missing the management skill. So it is the barrier to entry for what really hit this home for me when I moved into my grade A office. When we built that, we spent several million on the fit. And I remember signing a $250,000 check for office chairs. Like, we spent a lot of money on the fit.
You're Herman Miller.
Yeah. The year before we moved in, the building spent $40 million refurbishing the lobbies. I mean, it's a 52-story building, but basically it was built in the early 2000s, and it had this very Asian kind of orange peachy marble. And they were like, okay, we need the building to maintain its grade A status for its leasing. So they flipped all of it to this sort of blonde travertine. So they did, I don't even want to think of the environmental footprint of stripping out that much stone. Or how many square meters of stone that was, but they did all the lobbies, all 52 floors, they refaced all the lifts, and they bought a bunch of corporate art. And they were like, great, spend $50 million, it keeps our rents up by 20 cents, you know? And I went, yep, really, really, really easy for an institutional real estate trust to go and build co-working spaces. It's not hard. Mm-hmm. You know? And we're getting enough internationally sophisticated design firms, Gensler, are doing an awful lot of co-working fits. They do half of the operators in Singapore. Arguably, I think you shouldn't use an interior design firm to do a co-working fit, but that's me. Because they don't live with the outcome of what they design. And actually, one of the things I talk about in book two is this new movement of performance-based design, which has never existed before. Performance-based design used to be, we design it, you go into it, it looks nice, success.
Yep.
Co-working is, you design it, you put a bunch of sensors into it, you see if people use it. Yes.
How many people sit in the booth? Yeah. For how long does somebody camp out in a booth?
Yeah. Too long. You all said you wanted the booths. Do you use the booths?
Yes.
Yeah. Why aren't you using the booths? And then they go, because the aircon sucks. And you fix the aircon, then they use it. So I think I've lost this question. So where did we start?
Oh, wait, where were we starting? We were talking about lease tenure and then...
we were still under advice for kind of corporates or for landlords.
Oh, yeah, I guess I was right, because you were talking about corporates sort of giving up lease and having sort of paying on a per person use case. And so, I was curious, do you think they're going direct to landlord, or will there be an okay?
I think they'll go through their brokerage. I think
then you said they'll go to JLL and they'll go to CBRE, and CBRE will try to sell them HANA. And
The first corporate inquiry I had for per head space was an Asian bank. And they were like, could you get me 2,500 desks or 2,500 memberships? And I was like, there aren't that many in the Singapore co-working market now.
Right.
Like there isn't that available capacity. Mm-hmm. And they were like, that's our problem. They're like, if we're going to make this shift, I need, so like my core and flex, I need a flex of 2,500.
Wow.
And the way that you address, I think for the co-working industry to respond to that, like absolutely, if you're a co-working operator, that's a great operator, you're approached by a landlord right now, that's like, we need to build out a co-working thing. Let them buy you. You know, be that, and then convert them into having, you know, 20,000 desks across the country, and then do it that way.
Yep.
Essentially, I always thought one of the big plays WeWork was going for was to get that corporate leasing market. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the WeWork fit isn't pitched at a corporate client. So their acoustics aren't good enough. Their data security isn't good enough. They don't have enterprise phone systems through their spaces. So they were like, if we just build it big enough, then it'll be fine. And I was like, you got to build it to a corporate spec. So you don't meet their chairs and desking don't meet workplace health and safety standards. Their ergonomics aren't good enough. Right. Their lighting and you know, the Fortune 500 companies will get lawsuits for bad lighting and RSI.
Which is super interesting, because this came up on one of our, on the GWA conference, which is that in California, for example, the employer is still liable for employees in a co-working space, which to your point is messy on many levels, certainly messy during a global pandemic, but then they're right. So you sort of dig into like, well, then what are their requirements for the space and, you know, ergonomics and all the air quality, et cetera, the bar goes higher.
Yeah. And I think in Australia, they're liable for people working from home.
Wow.
The people I know that got sent home by large organizations in Australia were sent home with a checklist going, do you have an ergonomic chair? Do you have a table? If you don't, you can take them from the office, or like we can get them sent to you. And it's I mean, so essentially the gap right now is a specification gap, not necessarily a realistic quantum gap. And I think the challenge that WeWork has in terms of meeting that need, because they're the only operator that I know of that's actually of the scale that could do it, is they have a multi-billion dollar refit, because their acoustic part, their glass glazing doesn't meet optical privacy or acoustic privacy needs. A lot of their partitioning doesn't go to slab. Their desking and seating furniture is not to ergonomic standards. Yeah.
They're built to scale, not quality.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Oh, right. And but the problem is it's end to end. And then there's also all the issues with the data security on WeWork networks and stuff too. So like in our space in Capital Tower, I think I said this to you on a previous call, we had 150 or 160 VLANs. So literally we'd segmented all of our clients. So when a company came in, if they had an office, the office was already on a VLAN.
Yeah.
And then we had, so my own system took up an entire rack, 72U rack. And then we had three available client racks for firewalls, NAS, UPSs, et cetera. And that was what we needed to deal with, you know, big institute, the kind of companies that would put themselves in the fourth tallest building in Singapore require that kind of specification, that kind of space.
Yep.
You know, we had a Cisco, full Cisco enterprise telephone system, to BES 6, BES 6K, 6,000 servers, all that kind of stuff. Really, really heavy phone systems and all that kind of other bits and pieces, but you need it. So.
So what do you think about the hub and spoke theory? And is it practical that operators on the spokes can meet those standards?
Oh, okay. Yes, because we have been talking mainly about CBD operators in this discussion.
Yeah.
So the hub and spoke theory is much more the I think it works. I think it is, but again, it depends on the industry, because your certain industries, their office is more of a node than it is for others. So certain ones just require you to be there. So for regulatory requirements, financial services companies just need you to be in the office and on their network. That's just the thing they need.
Yep.
In certain roles. In other roles, tech is a great example. You can be far more diffuse. And I think, so there's an industry, there are industry relevant responses. And I think also if you're, I think my answer to this goes back to co-working for me has always been this Venn diagram of location, specification. I think I have a Venn diagram in the book.
You had some wonderful, for anybody listening, you had some wonderful illustrations of concepts in the book. Yes, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I do all of my own illustrations.
Market positioning, you have some of those charts. I mean, there's some very good visuals.
So it's one of the key things there is, one of the key areas is location, and basically going, are you solving a high barrier to entry, or are you solving diffuse population? I think specification is the right tools for the right problem. So hub and spoke is the right tool. If you are an industry that supports that, you're very cloud oriented, you can do a lot of things over video conferencing. Also, your work does not require specific equipment that needs people in the office. So like, you're not a car design firm and you require these big walls and digital drawing tables and stuff. We talked a bit about this at your GWA conference, but it used to be Core Flex. We've now got Core Flex and work from home. The work from home piece really nicely fits into hub and spoke operators.
Yeah.
Because after a certain amount of time at home, I mean, even I'm a co-working operator, but my work at home workstation is not as good as the workstation I have at Hub.
I know. Totally. So I'm the same way.
I don't have Herman Miller chairs at home, you know.
Right.
Maybe I should. But there is still that operator and there is still the need for socialization. And so yes, I think there is. I think actually you're out of town. Co-working operators are probably in a great spot right now, because if you, as a small operator, I'd rather be an out-of-town one.
Yep.
Small 100%. Downtown core, tricky.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'm looking at my list of questions for you to make sure we don't, there's a big one that we might have to make just a separate discussion.
I am happy to chat with you whenever you want me to, Jamie.
I'm going to save the digital community layer for another time, because I think we could go long on that one. The other thing I'm curious about, and I wonder if this is shifting or not, is you talk a lot about in the book about the consolidating the share of spend and sort of, you know, once you acquire a customer, getting them to spend more with you. Does that still hold post-COVID?
So that belief for me came from, let me think, this would have been 2016. So I had a co-working space. I spun up an accounting corporate services firm, as a like support service. It's very natural support services one. Mm-hmm. That kind of took off very quickly. So that was one example. The classic one in co-working is cafes or food and beverage proposition, but you need scale to justify that.
Yes.
I think there are arguments both ways. I mean, you can say, is it better to put an independent cafe operator in the space and have it all done really well? Or is it better to capture that share of spend? You know what? It depends by whose metrics. I mean, if you look at compared to an online business, co-working is low margin. Compared to a leasing business, co-working is high margin.
Right.
It really depends on your perspective.
Yeah.
But compared to a leasing or a REIT business, co-working is capital light and high yield. So I think if you're a landlord, you don't need to, because if you're a landlord, you'll just be like, let's get the best coffee place. Let's get the best accounting corporate services firm. again, really important to do scale with that one. We tried a partnership with a Big Four accounting firm, but they had an innovation side, and we put that into the space. Mm-hmm. Didn't really have a huge uptake. Literally having a bookkeeper that people could go and speak to, far more powerful.
Oh, right. Yep.
We also did a revenue share with an IT services firm. Mm-hmm. So we had our IT services firm, which was not owned by me. And we got them a desk in the space, which was like a help desk. So people could walk up and be like, my laptop's broken. Mm-hmm. And then we just took we had a little introduction fee for the time that they billed. And then that worked really well. What else did we do? We did I put my whole membership on a group insurance plan. So we did a membership insurance, and we saved the average member several thousand on their insurance by putting them all together as an insurable cohort. That was, so it was the first individual health insurance policy in Asia, mm-hmm. which was quite fun.
I know someone experimenting with that here, and I think it's super compelling. It's necessary the way our system works. I don't know how Singapore healthcare works, but I think that alone, if solvable, could be extremely compelling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we did by transferring my own company into this insurance plan, we saved, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 a year on our corporate insurance for our medical insurance for our team. Mm-hmm. And so the way the Singapore system works is, if you're Singaporean, there's like a Medicare type thing where it's at least partially paid, or your part of your salary goes into a medical fund, and then that covers some of your care. You can be still out of pocket for some expenses. If you're foreign, you're on your own, and you're at full price. and you're at full price medical care. So my own insurance, I think my personal insurance in Singapore is, because I still have it, I think it's 12 or 14,000 a year. So which is not scary to Americans. Americans are like, yep, that's about right.
That's
so,
right. Exactly. Yeah. Not ideal, but
no.
Yeah, we get it. Manageable.
Yeah. So so the reason we were so interesting to the insurer that we did that with was because I had a 75% expat community. The mean age was 31. They were 55% women.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. And they were like, we want to insure these people. These guys are low risk. So that was the fact we had a really good age cohort really helped. And we had a good gender makeup too.
Yeah. I think some of these services may play a role as we see sort of the shifting user segments. I mean, we think about the corporate work from home folks, that your IT example, they're used to having support. And now they don't have it, right? So who fixes the computer? When you're an entrepreneur, you know, like, you fix the computer, right?
Yes.
You deal with it or go to the Apple store. But, you know, if you're used to having an IT department and they're remote, then that may be a service that even the company buys into, depending on scale and whatnot. But I think it's smart to be thinking about what else. I have a captive audience.
The process of getting someone in as a co-working member is you spend all this time building up trust and then potentially modifying space, getting things to work for that person. And then if they leave or when they leave, all that revenue falls off a cliff. If you're still providing other services, things like accounting support, then actually you don't lose the client in its entirety. You get a long tail. So it is essentially, it's long tail economics. Mm-hmm. But also going, if you've got them here, you might as well provide that service or get someone in and get a commission for the introduction.
Right.
And it's essentially because the co-working relationship is all about trust. So if you've built trust in that area, if you can be I'm trying to think of the word I want to use. If you can be an arbitrator of taste and be like, this is the best IT firm we found. This is the best accounting firm we found.
Right.
This is, there are businesses have generic requirements. Everyone has to do annual filings. Everyone needs to keep books. Almost everyone drinks coffee or tea. There are some things that you can hit. Most people need health insurance. Childcare is a whole nother complexity. There's lots of things that people can do. And then also even, things like monetizing access to networks. So like things that we did with the Chambers of Commerce, we didn't monetize that, but you could. So we did look at going, we just have one, but we looked at going, if we got a bunch of Chambers of Commerce and put them together as a product, would that be something we could get people to subscribe to?
Yeah.
But again, you need the buy-in of the people that are being bundled to do that.
Right. Exactly. Jonathan, I feel like I've taken up half of your day here when you're probably anxious to hear about your belongings and whether they've arrived. Deal with all of your tax issues and whatnot. So your current book can be found wherever you buy books, on Amazon. Yep. Yeah,
it's on Amazon. It's in a lot of major bookstores. It's in Kinokuniya, Waterstones in the UK, which is kind of exciting. I felt like a grown up when that happened.
Totally, like you walk, like see the actual book.
It's a book, yeah,
and it's bright yellow for anyone who hasn't seen the cover yet. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
So we'll link to the show notes so that folks can find that. And what's the timeline on the new book?
It will be published before the end of the year. I'm trying to get it into layout by the end of October.
Okay. You're in hustle mode. I definitely need to let you go. You need to finish that book. Okay. Well, we'll have to have you back on so we can talk about the new book.
Would love it. Would love it.
Perfect. Thank you for sharing your perspective and taking time to do this. Super interesting. And we didn't even, there are lots of sort of global perspective questions I'd love to pick your brain on. So,
Next time.
We'll do it again. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan.
Right. You take care. Stay safe.